from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrad Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out what is naturally Victorian at the Morris Butler House.
I'll chat with Mark Baselli about his take on Miles Davis's Birth of the Cool.
And I'll get a preview of the American Pianist Association's concert featuring Nobu. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call What Will We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Handmade, sustainable, and earth-friendly sound like adjectives describing today's trends. But it turns out our Victorian-era ancestors were, well, more than a century ahead of us. That's what Sharon Gamble found out when she talked to Amy Forno about Naturally Victorian, a new exhibit on view now at the Morris Butler House.
So apparently a lot of what we consider trendy and stylish in terms of using natural cleaners and natural techniques isn't new at all. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. The great quantity of what was cooked in a 19th century kitchen was natural and came in cookbook form. You would occasionally open up a 19th century cookbook. While we were researching for our exhibit, we discovered this, and you'd find you wouldn't get to real recipes for what we would consider edible until 10, 15 pages in.
Really? So there, what were some of the things you found there in the early pages of some of those cookbooks?
Pontificating, most definitely. One of my favorite 19th century cookbooks is Lydia Maria Child's American Frugal Housewife. She offers very few recipes for anything edible, but she does give instructions on how to prolong the life of all sorts of household goods. And basically, I think of the theme of her book as prevention is, you know, is worth an ounce of cure. So she explains to the housewife that being frugal and raising your children and your family to be frugal is really the best thing you can do for them.
Paint the picture, because I think sometimes those of us who live in 2010 are so used to all of the conveniences, it's hard to even know what a Victorian kitchen would have had. There was no icebox yet, right? Was the icebox around?
Actually, there was an icebox.
There was an icebox, okay.
So there was rudimentary refrigeration available.
What was an icebox like? How did it work?
Well, an icebox functions basically using real live ice. So the interior is lined with zinc. The one we have at the museum it's got three compartments. On the right-hand side, there's a smaller compartment that holds a block of ice, 30, 40, or 50-pound block of ice.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a drip tray underneath in an even smaller compartment. And more of the interior space is taken up by the ice than the food that you would be able to preserve inside. Ours has actually an ice water chiller as well, which is something you don't see too often. So that takes up even more space. And then there's a space for some shelves, and you would chill food inside this. But of course, it's only going to get as cold as, say, the inside of a cooler in the middle of the summer.
Sure.
So it's not the most effective way of cooling food, but it was the only way
right.
to really cool food.
So what else would be in a Victorian kitchen? There'd be some kind of cook stove.
There would be a cook stove, which honestly is a pretty major innovation. Very early on in the late 18th century, early 19th century, the hearth was still the method of cooking for most families, especially out west. And having a cook stove would have been a great thing. Cooking over coal provides you a lot more control over the way you're heating your food. So instead of simply moving it 6 inches or 2 inches away from the fire to you know, boil versus sauté, you would actually be able to adjust the temperature by giving the fire more air or less air on the cook stove, or moving your pans further away from the firebox, which is traditionally on one side of the stove.
So we have a way to keep food cold. We have a way to cook food. Mm-hmm. What else is in the kitchen?
Well, you would find a table in most Victorian kitchens. Children were not allowed in the dining room until they had memorized the rules of etiquette. So youngish children would have been in the kitchen with the cook, working on their manners and eating whatever the cook was eating. Not always the exact same foods that were being served at the table. And you would also find almost always a pie safe, which is a way to save a little bit of that ice. A pie safe has punched holes in tin, so it allows air circulation. You could cool your foods off inside of that before you put them into your ice box.
Uh-huh.
So you would use a little bit less ice over the course of a day.
Did people put, I mean, obviously there was leftover food. What would you put your leftovers in? Would they just be stored in the pots after you transferred them to let them cool a little bit, stored in whatever you cook them in?
Yes, you could do that. Stoneware, crocks were also very popular as just general use storage containers for this time period. And then the best use of your leftovers was in the next meal you were having. So if you had lots of bread or other pastries in the morning with your breakfast, you might find a bread pudding for dessert at the end of the day.
That's a very responsible reuse, recycle kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this idea for Naturally Victorian start? Did this come from?
Well, we originally, I guess it was almost 2 years ago, had this idea to do a food exhibit. And we wanted to focus just on food, but then we came to the conclusion that I alluded to earlier, that way more things were cooked in a 19th century kitchen than average everyday food. So looking through these recipe books, you find information on how to clean silk, information on how to mix your own home remedies for someone who's feeling ill. And the kitchen really was more than just a place where food was being made. So we broadened our scope a little bit there and really began to think about the relationship between being traditional and being technologically advanced, which is something I think we struggle with now immensely. We have all of these new innovations coming out day after day, and we struggle with how we're going to reduce and reuse and recycle while also consuming huge quantities of stuff, be that information or actual objects. And looking back, that's exactly the same struggle that the Victorians had. They were in a time where invention was really the mode.
And the Industrial Revolution is going on, and all these manufactured goods are coming our way.
Exactly. So really, they were hit with these same problems that we're being just battered with nowadays. But at the same time, they didn't have the same quick transportation that we have. The quickest transportation for someone back then would have been train. Nowadays, we can send things in airplanes, and it takes a matter of hours for us to get food from across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
So some things just weren't possible for them, and so they still had to make do, be frugal, preserve the harvest, and keep things from disintegrating too early. There were no disposables back then, with the exception of paper collars for gentlemen.
You know, it's funny, I was talking with someone in the office at my day job earlier today about some friends of his who simply don't cook, and they actually use their kitchen for clothes storage. They store shoes, they store clothing in the kitchen. And what you've described of the Victorian era kitchen is, it feels like truly the heart of the home, where you, that's where you go when you have a tummy ache, that's where you go when you're hungry, that's where you go when you need to clean something. Was the kitchen in the Victorian era primarily the province of the woman? I mean, I'm assuming it was. Were men allowed in the kitchen?
I can't say men were disallowed from the kitchen, though the Victorian era is a little different from our own in that the kitchen was really off limits more generally. People had an idea that things had a specific use. So your kitchen was a place where work happened, and the leisurely middle and upper class didn't spend time in the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
So when I host a party at my home, I have friends who eat in my kitchen,
sure,
and who help me in my kitchen, but that would have been unheard of in the Victorian era for a middle class or an upper class family trying to keep up appearances. So while certainly the lady of the house, her daughters, her sons, and maybe even the man of the house would enter the kitchen and perhaps even pitch in helping with the cleaning or the cooking, you certainly wouldn't find them admitting to it if they could help it.
You know, I know you have a lot of workshops affiliated with this exhibit. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I'm looking very forward to April 13th, when we'll be doing a green spring cleaning workshop, which really focuses on the unorthodox things that you find in 19th century cookbooks. It's not really a cookbook, it's more of a household guide.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be looking at modern day chemical concoctions and their Victorian counterparts, and trying to find a way to be more natural in our homes when we conduct our spring cleaning, which is nowhere near as intense as the 19th century spring cleaning would have been, but they would have had all of their own homemade products to clean the house from top to bottom.
And go back for a second. Why is that? Why are we not as ambitious about spring cleaning?
You know, I'm not sure why we aren't. Spring cleaning was really invented in the Victorian era.
Really?
And it was a outgrowth of the sanitation reform movement.
Okay, there you go.
People were beginning to understand more fully where disease comes from, how germs looked. They were actually being able to look at these things under microscopes. And quite frankly, it creeped people out. So they began to try to come up with ways to deal with this problem. And sanitation reformers very early on suggested that you go so far as to take apart every piece of furniture in your house.
Oh, my gosh.
Sanitize all the screws that held it together. So it was a very intense, very time-consuming process.
That makes me feel so lucky.
Oh, I know. I suspected it was called spring cleaning because it did take
the whole
bulk of that season.
Wow.
And today, I think we have so many other things just sucking our time away from us that the thought of spending an entire season of our lives cleaning our house from top to bottom is really
horrifying.
Horrifying to us, yes.
Two things strike me, and maybe this, as you talk with some of your presenters during the next better part of the year, because one of the great things about this exhibition is that it will change to reflect the seasons,
mm-hmm,
and to what might have been done a century and plus ago. But as electric lights became more common, I have read that people, especially the woman in charge of the home, became enlightened, so to speak, about how dirty the house really was.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's kerosene lamps are lovely, but once you flick on an electric light, you can see all the dirt in every
mm-hmm.
corner. And maybe we clean more regularly now because we can see better. But also, Victorian furniture had a lot more places for germs to hide than most of what we have now.
Absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. Ours is all angles.
Yeah.
And they had all these deep carvings and
all that fabric.
And really finicky,
finicky
pieces. Plus, they had more furniture. To have bare space was a sign of poverty in a Victorian parlor. So they were just jam-packed with all sorts of pieces of furniture, rugs, drapes.
Do you have a favorite technique or concoction that of working on this exhibit that you've started using at your own home?
Absolutely. I cannot speak kindly enough of vinegar. You can use it for virtually anything. You can use it as a hair rinse. You can use it as a disinfectant, but it is a mild rather than a heavy disinfectant, so you can't really expect for it to kill everything.
Sure.
But it gets rid of hard water stains. It cleans your bathtub, your toilet, your sink, the grout between your tiles. And it's so safe that you could put it in a salad dressing.
Sharon Gamble with Amy Forno. You can see Naturally Victorian at the Morris Butler House through December 30th, and it will change content with the seasons. For more information, visit historiclandmarks.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
By giving his album the title Birth of the Cool, Miles Davis might have been, well, a bit driven by ego to assume this compilation of recordings from 1949 and 1950 would have such a place in jazz history. But then again, his prediction was right, so who can argue? This weekend, the Biseli-Wallerab Jazz Orchestra will play four concerts at the Jazz Kitchen, each one taking a go at playing the 12 songs from Davis's album. The shows take place at 8 and 10 on both Friday and Saturday. That's p.m., by the way. Travis DiNicola spoke with trumpeter Mark Biseli about the concert. Joining them in the studio was Mark's daughter, Sophia.
Mark, welcome to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
Thank you very much, Travis.
And
pleasure to be here.
Even though I know you'll be doing most of the talking, your daughter Sophia is here as well. Sophia, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Mark, I am just so excited, I got to say, that you guys are doing the Birth of Cool album. Miles Davis's amazing, historic, jazz album. You're performing basically what the entire album in all the tracks in order. Is that right at the Jazz Kitchen, or are you mixing up a bit?
I think we're going to mix them up a bit, but the goal is to do them in order.
Okay,
that's how I've been practicing them.
Now I know you said you've done this before,
right?
A couple years back and stuff, but it's still got to be. I can't even imagine the challenge of taking on this album and trying to do it justice. Now, if anyone can, you can. I mean, you're a great trumpeter. I'm looking forward to hearing
it. Oh, wow. Thank you very much. It's getting the role of, Romeo in a Shakespeare play or something. This is a trumpet player's dream role. Gil Evans, one of the primary arrangers on this, and Johnny Carisi and Jerry Mulligan all came together in Gil's apartment. I don't know if you knew.
It was a basement apartment?
Yeah, he had a basement
in New York
apartment.
That they would practice in?
And it was funny because he said in his 2 years of having that apartment, he never locked the door.
Really?
He would go out, and musicians would be there at night, and they were talking about different concepts. And the concept of this Birth of the Cool album really started with the Claude Thornhill band.
Okay.
Gil was writing for Claude Thornhill's band in the early 40s. And, you got to remember, in the early 40s, we had, bebop.
Mm-hmm.
Swing was still prevalent. The swing musicians were out playing with nice vibratos. The bebop musicians weren't really playing with vibratos, but they were playing a very small group, very fast, technically difficult music.
Okay. And swing was definitely, sort of at the time, still the most popular.
Absolutely.
And when we say cool, I mean, we're referring to a type of, we talk about cool as being, it's got a different meaning than it does in some ways when we think of what the word cool means today. It's hip, and that certainly carries over, but it also referred to a tight style, right?
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. The cool style, many people think of the Pacific Coast, the breezes,
West Coast,
kind of laid back. But when we talk about the style of music, we're actually talking about compressing the ranges of the instruments to the middle range.
Okay.
And we're talking about a primarily vibrato-less music. And this particular album that we're doing is really amazing because Gil and Miles talked about weeding out the instruments but still retaining the harmonic structure of what they wanted to achieve with the least amount of instruments. And so they came up with these instruments that weren't really often used in jazz, like the French horn, the tuba.
Yeah.
Now,
when you say, compress the range, are we talking about sort of a narrow range? I mean, not like the really low and high notes?
When you talk about bebop, the primary trumpet player of the day was Dizzy Gillespie, and he's soaring into the stratosphere.
All over the place.
And so along comes Miles, and Miles, he plays in a very restricted range. He doesn't go too high, he doesn't go too low. It's right in the middle, which makes you feel very comfortable. It makes the listener feel drawn in, I think, a little bit more.
The title, though, Birth of the Cool.
Right.
I mean, both prophetic and also, pretty audacious to say, album that is the birth of cool.
You know what's really interesting to me about this whole thing? It was recorded in January and April of 1949 and March of 1950. Three sessions, each consisting of 3 hours apiece. No rehearsal.
Huh.
And think about it, no overdubs back then.
Yeah.
They couldn't do that. I mean, if you listen along the album, you see a bunch of splices here and there.
Uh-huh.
Especially when Miles is playing a long time, and all of a sudden at the end of his phrase, he comes in fresh as a daisy on his solo.
Hmm.
That's definitely a splice.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think what's lacking in today's recording is this honesty. dishonesty. If something didn't go right, this is it. This was the session
the
right here.
Today
you hear, I mean, anybody can be a star today. Mm-hmm. With the things they have in the studio, they can make a singer seem incredible because they can take each singer's notes mm-hmm. and bend it for pitch. They can fix every horn player's mistake.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, but this was, I mean, what you hear is what you were getting.
That's right.
And this was, it was a group of nine musicians.
Yes.
And it's the nonet, is that
well, yeah, it was
how
a,
you pronounce it?
It was a nonet, but when you talk about the musicians, you had Miles on the trumpet. Yeah. Then, you know, the French horn duties were shared by Junior Collins and Sandy Siegelstein. Tuba, you had John Barber, Barry Sax was Jerry Mulligan. Alto Sax was Lee Konitz. The Bone was Kai Winding and J.J. Johnson.
Okay, yeah.
Piano, Al Hag, John Lewis. Bass, Joe Schulman, Nelson Boyd, Al McKibben. Drums, Kenny Clark, a founder of the bebop era, and Max Roach. And then, so that's pretty interesting to me.
What a great album. And it was historic.
It was historic, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you ever heard it?
Yes, I do. I was in Boston.
Yeah?
I was in Boston. I was going to Berklee School of Music, and somebody says, you got to check this out right here. And I remember sitting down, and I remember not getting up until it was done.
Just listen all the way through. You know, it's an interesting album in that it's 12 cuts, and each one's pretty short.
Yeah, they're all, you know. Well, I mean, I'm not sure, but the long-playing album didn't come in until maybe in the 50s or something.
Yeah, so they were sort of keeping them like around like 3 minutes or so.
Yeah.
A little bit more, you know, but by much though, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you heard it, and you couldn't get up until you heard the whole thing. I mean, what did you think of that?
I thought, you know, up until that point, I had been introduced to jazz through Clifford Brown and Dizzy and Charlie Parker and this up-tempo, real energy full of, and then I heard this album and I heard, it was like a cornucopia of colors flowing out, you know, just all of these different colors. Just and with a minimum of instrumentation, I had just been getting into arranging.
Okay.
And so this was one of our assignments to listen to this from an arranging standpoint, and I thought it was just amazing, the writing.
Now, as you're rehearsing for this, practicing, getting ready for the show. And you're doing actually four shows at the Jazz Kitchen, right?
So yeah, we're doing
8 and 10 Friday and Saturday?
Yeah, Friday to... Exactly, you got it.
Okay. Now, as you're getting ready to do this with the band, how do you go about deciding how you're going to perform? I mean, you guys are all, you know, I mean, great musicians on your own. And I know you also really enjoy, you know, the way that you arrange pieces. So, I mean, are you trying to... You're not trying to recreate it exactly, or are you?
We're trying to recreate the vibe of it.
Okay.
But as far as, like, the original solos, we're not going to go so far as to, like, each play, like, you know, play Miles' written solo.
Yeah.
Although I'm still attempting to play his solo on Move. It's incredible, man.
Yeah.
But I will probably play my own solos.
Okay.
But we're still trying to maintain the texture and the feeling of the arrangements.
Tell me who you've got playing with you.
Well, we've got Brent Walraves playing trombone and conducting. We've got Rob Dixon on alto saxophone, Ned Boyd on Barry saxophone, Celeste Howler's playing the horn, Jack Helsley's playing tuba.
Okay.
Jack was a tuba major. He's a bass player around
here.
Yeah,
I mean, I've only ever seen Jack play bass.
Well, he's playing tuba on this. Jack, you better be practicing. Jesse Whitman's on bass, Dave Scalia's on drums, and Zach Lapidus is on piano.
Great. So how's it going with the rehearsals and stuff?
You know, we're doing this this interview, what's today?
Well, we're recording about a week ahead of time. Friday,
right.
A week ahead, so...
So this is going to be...
You guys got a lot of work to do this week?
We're doing this, we're rehearsing Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That should be kind of, it should be a good day for you guys.
It should be a good day. 4 hours of it.
Now, have you ever attempted to perform any other Davis's albums like this? I mean, sort of doing the whole...
Yeah. We did Porgy and Bess at the IHS, and that was one of my all-time favorites that we did, that particular concert. It was just a monster to pull that together, you know, with all the different instrumentalists
on that.
I had always hoped to do Sketches of Spain, but
I was going to ask you.
You know, that I love that. I love that recording. but I've never gotten to do that in its entirety.
Well, this will be just a great night, I think, and a really great opportunity, especially for people who maybe have not heard Vasily Walrab before, to come out and hear you guys. I know you're just going to knock this one out of the park.
And well, thank you, Travis. I think we're going to do it in the round too, which is kind of neat because people eat dinner around you as we're playing, as opposed to the stage.
There's this great one photograph that's pretty famous that's inside the liner notes and stuff.
Yeah.
Like all the guys sort of sitting around, in the studio.
Uh-huh.
And you can, sort of picture, like people sort of hanging out around as well, listening to stuff. So, very cool. Do you have a favorite track out of the whole mix? I mean, there's, you mentioned, what was the one you mentioned?
I mentioned Move.
Move, yeah, okay. Which is the opening piece,
Yeah. Boplicity, Deception. I love this tune called Deception. It's hard for me to pick a favorite, but if I had to, it would probably be Deception.
Mark, thanks so much for coming in. And Sophie, I got to ask you, are you a jazz musician yourself?
Well, I play piano. I have a trumpet from my dad, but I don't really play the trumpet that much. I usually play the piano, so I'm taking piano lessons in school.
Well, good for you. That's a good background. Maybe someday give the trumpet more of a try, but I wish you luck with your piano playing.
Thanks.
You guys have a great rest of the weekend, and thanks a lot for being on Art of the Matter.
Thank you very much, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with trumpeter Mark Buscelli of the Buscelli Walrab Jazz Orchestra, and with them as well was Sophia Buscelli. This weekend, the Buscelli Walrab Jazz Orchestra will play four concerts at the Jazz Kitchen, each one taking a go at playing Miles Davis's album, Birth of the Cool. The shows take place at 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. on both Friday and Saturday. More information is available at thejazzkitchen.com, thejazzkitchen.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know what I miss being a grown-up and out of school?
Let's see. Spring break.
Spring break.
Of course.
I know.
Well, maybe you should just create your own.
I think that is an excellent way for us to introduce our arts calendar thing we call
What'll We Do? Hey, one thing I do want to mention, the music you're listening to right now, in the background is from the Miles Davis album, Birth of the Cool.
Ooh, so cool.
Okay. Hey, fun things to start planning to do on spring break. I don't know if you remember me about a year ago or so. I had the actor Tim Hardy in. He was doing a production about Galileo.
Yeah,
he's from the Royal Shakespeare Company, and he was in town. He was at IUPUI. Well, he's coming back and doing a return engagement at the Indie Fringe Theater, April 2nd through the 4th. It's a one-man show celebrating the 400th anniversary of Galileo's discoveries. And really, really cool time. A great show and worth checking out.
You know, in my day job over at the Phoenix Theater, we have a lot of contact with Butler University, and the Butler kids are just mad about Tim Hardy. They're like, line up behind him like little ducklings. I love that. I love that. Here's something that's coming up on March 27th. It's a one-day-only Women in Art Market celebrating creativity from a women's perspective at the Eideljort Museum. You can purchase basketry, fiber art, ceramics, painting, and other work by more than 50 women artists, many of them representative of Native American and Western art on view at the Eideljort. So, by the way, while you're there, you should check out the cool pistols exhibit as
well. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, if you missed the opening for Christopher West Presents, which was actually Thursday, March 18th, for his new show, Fear of Flying, you can still check it out at the Dean Johnson Gallery. And the show features three artists, New York-based Josh Azarelia, and Indianapolis-based Stacey Holloway, and Los Angeles-based Ewan McDonald. It's the first ever group show at the Christopher West Presents, and it's bringing together these three different artists from three different very places dealing with planes and flying, and perhaps their fear of it. Should be a really interesting show, certainly worth checking out at Christopher West Presents on Mass Avenue.
If you are interested in getting out and meeting some new folks and maybe just doing something a little bit different, you're invited to join folks at the Athenaeum on Tuesday the 23rd. That's this coming Tuesday, 6 to 6:30 refreshments, 6:30 to 7:15 a presentation, 7:15 to 7:45 a short tour. What are they calling it? Well, it's a German social and athletic club, or at least it was. So they're calling it a volunteer open House, H-A-U-S, of course. And they're inviting you to become a volunteer with a range of volunteer opportunities available at the 116-year-old historic landmark. Some volunteer events on the horizon. You'll hear more about this on an edition of Art of the Matter coming up soon. The installation of a rain garden, and they're looking for a whole bunch of volunteers for that, so you'll hear more about that later. But in the meanwhile, volunteer evening on Tuesday, March 23rd, starting at 6 and going till just before 8 at the Athenaeum.
Hey, visual artists out there, are you listening? Mayor Ballard needs your help. He is seeking artwork for his office. He wants to showcase artworks by Indianapolis artists in the mayor's office at the city council building. So any form and any size of 2D work is acceptable. I'm sure you could push that a little bit, but that's what they say. And works may also be for sale. They're going to try to rotate them on a regular basis. And they are accepting applications through March 31st. You need to go online and contact the mayor's office and let them know about your artwork. But it's a pretty cool opportunity.
Excellent. If you're out of school and you're not able to get away for spring break, but you still want to plan a little trip, may I suggest Chicago?
That sounds like a fine idea. I just got back.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And you left it still standing, so the rest of us can go up and take advantage of a whole bunch of cool half-day bus tours. These, you can find out lots more about these at a website called cityofchicago.org. But they're affordable. They're half-day tours, and they include everything from tours of Polish Chicago to tours of Daniel Burnham Chicago to White City tours. If you don't know what that reference is, you should go on one of these tours. There are church and temple and sanctuary tours. There's food to be toured and architecture to be toured and just all sorts of amazing ways to see the Windy City. And you can find out more at cityofchicago.org.
There you are. Folk musicians, the Central Indiana Folk Music and Mountain Dulcimer Society will be holding its monthly meeting on April 11th in the basement of the Bethlehem Lutheran Church at 52nd and Central Avenue. From 2 until 5 will be time for performances, big band practice, and a sharing circle. Visitors are always welcome. More information can be found at indianafolkmusic.org.
If you love jazz, of course, I hope you already have it on your calendar to go see the Bocelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra cover Miles Davis's Birth of the Cool this weekend, but more on the horizon. At the University of Indianapolis on April 7th, Rufus Reed, bass player at 7:30, featured in an ensemble free jazz concert, and that's on Monday at 7:30 on April 7th.
You know, I'm a big fan of the Roller Derby Gals. Their sort of minor league team is the Circle City Socialites. And, Sharon, we got an email from Faye Stunaway and Vivi Section inviting us to their upcoming event. It's the Black Eye Affair. And, well, that sounds... It's April 10th.
What are you
10th.
Aware of that?
It's a doubleheader on April 10th, and it's featuring their brother league, the Race City Rebels, which is one of the few all-male roller derby leagues.
What?
And,
I didn't know there was such
a thing.
I know.
I can't believe
you're not playing on one.
They're going to be skating up at the Forum in Fishers. More information at CircleCitySocialites.com.
And I have something else on the horizon. It is the Alphabet Affair. Sponsored this year by the letter L. The letter L. It benefits Indie Reads. It's coming up on Saturday, May 1st at the Hyatt Regency. And I got to go to this last year, and it was so much fun. And the idea is you can wear a black tie, but that's kind of dull. The real thing to do is to figure out a costume that reflects the letter L. And on
what
the
are
invitation,
you going as, Sharon?
I don't know yet. I just got my invitation today, but some of the ideas on the invitation include lemur, Lady Gaga, Leonardo da Vinci, or a leprechaun. So I can think of lots of L things.
I'm sure you can.
Yeah. Oh. Anyway, contact Indie Reads for more information and to get your tickets to the Alphabet Affair May 1st.
And we will be back with more ideas for spring break and L costumes next week on
What'll We Do?
Thank you.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The announcement of 20-year-old Japanese pianist Nobuyuki Tsuji as winner of the Nancy Lee and Perry R. Bass Gold Medal at the 13th Van Cliburn International Piano Competition marked a significant historic milestone for both this extraordinary artist and the competition. Nobu, as he's called, was already known in his home country for his refined and effortless playing, all the more extraordinary because he's been blind from birth. The American Pianist Association is bringing Nobu to Indy for a concert at the Basile Theater at the Indiana History Center on Sunday, April 18th at 3:30 as part of its chamber music series. He'll play two Beethoven sonatas, The Moonlight and The Appassionata, plus a selection of mazurkas, nocturnes, and more by Chopin. Sharon Gamble invited the APA's Joel Harrison to tell us more about Nobu's concert and about a remarkable APA jazz announcement.
Well, I want to start with kind of a technique question that I want you to answer as a pianist, not as the person shepherding APA. How important is a sense of sight to being a musician?
Well, I would say a sense of sight's extremely important to a musician, at least as in the way that we are traditionally taught, and that is actually one of the things that puts Nobuyuki in a class by himself to some extent as a classical musician and as the brilliant pianist that he is. But, you know, traditionally we are taught that we come up with our musical ideas by studying the score,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that there is a visual aspect to learning the music. And I don't mean just reading the notes, but studying it, you know, for all of the shapes, the different symbols that the composer uses, comparing this score to another score, you know, all these kinds of things that to us sighted musicians, if you will, seems to make a difference. In the case of Nobuyuki, of course, he does not have that aspect.
And has never had it.
And has never had it. That's right. And, you know, so we're just all kind of in amazement. Of course, you can teach somebody to literally play the piano, you
sure.
know, that physical aspect, the technical aspect. But in his case, to learn to ascertain what is there on the printed page is quite a feat. So he does that with the assistance of any number of mentors who help him find his way, if you will, through the path of the printed score.
Here's an odd question. Is there such a thing as Braille music?
Yes, there is.
And is it widely in use among blind musicians?
I can't really answer because I don't know.
Yeah.
There's also large print music. That's not Braille, of course.
Sure, sure.
But for people who do have limited sight, that's all available. There's a special section of the Library of Congress that provides that to people.
As someone who, part of whose job is adjudication and critically, in the positive sense, reviewing musicianship, how do you take out that factor so that the folks at Van Cliburn or any of the many competitions that Nobu's been in, how do you suppose people approach this? Do they say to their juries, you just ignore the fact that this pianist has no sight?
I don't know that anybody says ignore it. It'd be pretty hard to ignore it if you're in the, you know, in the hall.
Yeah.
How you go about learning your music, though, is not what's up for grabs at a competition of the level of the Clyburn or APA or the violin competition here, or, you know, any of that.
It's like,
do you have something to say? Have you absorbed these notes and, you know, developed a relationship with that music in such a way that you have your own unique connections, is the word I like to use, your connections with the music and with the score, and can you impart that through the piano in an effective way, you know, in a way that is compelling to the listener? So, you know, quite frankly, whether to me, as a jury member of a competition of this nature, none of that's an issue. If you could, you know, if you're blind from birth or had some horrible accident when you were 10 or 12 and can no longer see, or whatever that might be, that's not what I'm there to figure out.
Sure.
You know, is this a compelling musical performance? And in a way, in a competition, it's not even about what else do you know, because you're having to make judgment on what you hear on this particular occasion, on this day. I hear this, and so I make this particular critical judgment. Now, if I had known the particular pianist for a period of 2 years and had heard them play in a variety of halls and a variety of settings and play chamber music and concerto and solo music, you know, I might make a different judgment. But you can't do, you know, a jury, I mean, actually, the APA jury, in a way, does, because our process, as you know, runs throughout an entire concert season. But for most of
them, that's a luxury.
Yes, it is. It's a luxury for everybody,
yeah.
But most especially for the finalists who are performing, because they're really being heard under ideal circumstances. But no, a jury is empowered to make their decision on the basis of what they hear today or at the moment. And any jury member with integrity, I'm sure, would say, if we came back and heard these same people play a year from now, play the same repertoire in the same hall, et cetera, et cetera, the decision might be different. I mean, that's kind of this thing about competitions. You know, we make our decision now. That doesn't mean that the other people aren't talented and aren't deserving of our awards or aren't deserving of professional careers. Unfortunately, we're forced to make a decision at the moment.
Sure.
And so we have to do it at that time. So that he has been blind from sight makes it his achievement all the more remarkable, because it certainly has not been easy. But if I were on the jury, that would not be an issue. I would admire his accomplishment, but it would not enter in how I listen to his performance.
Can you tell us the story of what inspired him to music and what drew him to the piano?
I don't know.
Okay. Maybe we'll ask him after the concert.
That would be a good idea. His English is fairly limited,
yeah,
I can tell you.
But music is the universal language, and it's a challenging program. I mean, the
yes.
Two Beethoven sonatas.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, lots of people today, I mean, in New York and Carnegie Hall, you have these people who come through and they'll play all 32 of the Beethoven sonatas over a period of, you know, X number of concerts.
Yeah.
Exactly, Richard Good, exactly. But to hear one Beethoven sonata these days is wonderful, but to hear two on the same program from the same artist is really rather surprising.
Yeah.
And that the ones that he's playing are, you know, perhaps the best known. I don't recall in my professional years hearing the Moonlight Sonata performed by a pianist in sort of a major concert setting.
And I haven't been listening to music all that long in Indianapolis, but I don't recall, and maybe one of our listeners will email us and correct this, but I don't recall anybody who's performed in Indy doing two Beethoven sonatas in the same concert.
I hesitate to say.
Yeah.
Because like you, I'm sure as soon
someone
as I say something, someone knows
history,
and they'll say. Right?
John Gates will call
exactly.
Or email and correct us. But the Moonlight and the Appassionata, and that's just the first half of the
program. I can say is I haven't heard it.
There you go. Okay. We're safe. And that's just the first half of the program. And then some delightful and, you know, crowd-pleasing Chopin in the second half.
Right. Which is appropriate. You know, this is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Chopin. So what a great year to be out there performing Chopin.
Absolutely. What is your goal with this Grand Encounters series?
The goal is several-fold, and I would offer my thanks to Alan White O'Clues Charitable Trust for underwriting this concert series. As I started thinking about things a few years ago, I realized we were not hearing major international artists in a solo recital in Indianapolis. We hear them, of course, with the ISO and, mm-hmm. and with the chamber orchestra, but I thought, this is a shame. Here we are, you know, the American Pianist Association, with our executive offices here, one of the larger cities in the United States. This is kind of an embarrassing statement.
There's a and void in
yes, there.
Yes, there is. That needs to be filled.
Yes, and so I set about, you know, doing a little bit of research on that. And then the other was, you know, I wanted to have a concert series that featured pianists in a variety of venues. We have wonderful spaces here in the city. And I didn't want all of the concerts to be in the same spot. I wanted to use that as an outreach opportunity, but also I wanted to develop a great love of hearing pianists in halls where it's sort of this visceral response, you know, where it's small enough that you just sort of feel the air vibrate. So, you know, we started out the season at the DeHaan Center. And the Ruth Lilly Concert Hall was, of course, a spectacular.
One of the best acoustics.
One
of the
best. Just superb. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was downtown in the Omni Severn Hotel in the ballroom. Years ago, when I first went in that ballroom, I thought, boy, wouldn't this be great to do a candlelight concert in this space? It sort of looks like Viennese, you know. And
That's true.
So we developed this, you know, series around that. And then, of course, we use the wonderful Indiana History Center and the Bazille Theater, which is a marvelous space, mm-hmm. With some degree of frequency, so that became you know, an obvious choice.
And I have to say, especially for people who follow piano, the sight lines are
yes,
terrific there.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Right.
Not just the sound, but a lot of people that have played piano at some point in their lives, whether they consider themselves pianists
right.
or not, and people are more than maybe any other instrument fascinated by watching.
Yeah, it's a wonderful hall, you know, a decent acoustic, nice size, piano sounds excellent in there. You know, you can adjust the draperies sort of right, you know, they're around the top there to help out the sound a bit. And it's a great location. The parking's free.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get there early, you know, you can wander through the museum or the shop there and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So it's really, we use the History Center with some degree of frequency.
Mm-hmm. Shifting gears to jazz, you've had a recent announcement of something that I'm still trying to absorb how you were able to swing this. You've just announced an increase in the top prize for the jazz company.
Yes, beginning with the announcement of the winner of the 2011 Jazz Fellowship Awards, the winner will receive a cash prize of $50,000 and be named the Cole Porter Fellow in Jazz of the American Pianist Association. That is the largest award to a jazz pianist in the world. And I think possibly the largest jazz award in the history of jazz. I can't speak with great authority on that one because I haven't,
you know,
but it just seems to, you know, probably is. But, you know, if someone out there in the audience knows otherwise, please call. But it is the largest, you know, jazz award to a pianist in a competition in the United States.
That's astonishing. I don't want to. I wouldn't want to be in your office when, you know, everybody wraps his or her mind around it and you get.
Well, I can tell you what's going to be hard is
more than usual.
When we get to the finals and we have to make the announcement, you know, because mm-hmm. they're the five brilliant finalists
yeah.
on stage and. Already I'm getting a little shaky over, you know, announcing who won only, you know, just
yeah.
there's just that one winner of $50,000. But indeed, that is what's going to happen.
That is stunning.
And we're doing the same thing for classical. I mean,
yeah.
you know, because
yeah.
they're on parity. So we won't have the finals of the next classical competition to 2013. But again, that cash prize will be $50,000.
Well, you have a little bit of time to prepare yourself, to steel yourself to make that decision.
Yeah. And you know, this we've also, in addition to the increase in the cash award, we're expanding the entire format by which we do the competition so that it more equitably follows the path that we use for the Classical Fellowship Awards. Thus, beginning in September of 2010, we will have what we call the Jazz Premiere Series. And we're going to bring each of our five jazz finalists to the city for a week at a time. And they will do a number of community outreach concerts, a three-day residency with the high school. And then on Saturday night of the week that they're here, they'll do a fully produced set with two sidemen at the Jazz Kitchen.
Oh, fabulous.
And that will be an adjudicated concert. You know, we will have a three-member jury here for that. So that starts in September, runs through February of 2011. So this is, while we've been doing that for about 10 years now with the Classical Awards, this is the first time we've done this with the Jazz Awards.
Is anybody doing that for jazz?
Nobody's doing that for classical, much less for jazz.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, because I appreciate what's behind the scenes of that, the mechanics, the operations, the logistics, and the frankly the fundraising to be able to get these.
It's put a little more pressure on the staff of APA, as you mentioned, just to raise the money, not just for the prize. Actually, raising money for a high-profile prize
is
relatively easy. I won't say it's easy, but
right.
Easier. Trying to raise money to run the operations of APA and to fund the entire process of the Jazz Fellowship Awards is a little more difficult. So we've got more on our plate, but it's all in the service of art and wonderful young American musicians, pianists, so I'm happy to do it.
Sharon Gamble with the American Pianists Association, Joel Harrison. You can hear Clyburn gold medalist Nobuyuki Tsuji at the Basile Theater at the Indiana History Center on Sunday, April 18th at 3:30. For more information, visit AmericanPianist.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 p.m. I'll take a dip in the Athenaeum's rain garden.
I'll chat with Shannon Forsell about the new season at the Cabaret.
And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.